All right, so on the last time that we were together, a week ago today, we talked about the issue of suffering.
And this is actually something the New Testament says an awful lot about, that we, in order to be like Christ, we are going to suffer like him. Jesus even said as much when he said, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and do what? Yeah, take up your cross. So that's just inherent in the very notion of what it is to follow Christ, is to suffer like him. And if you remember, last Sunday we looked at a lot of passages. We were really booking it to get through all of them, but we were looking at a lot of passages that talk about us sharing in the suffering of Christ. But one of the things that you may have noticed about those passages is that many of them, even as they talk about suffering like Christ, also immediately turn to talk about being glorified with him. Okay, great. We're a little technical. They keep trying to shut me down here, but we're just not going to stop. We'll keep going. A lot of them talk about being glorified like Christ. And that is, of course, what our theme passage this year is all about. Christ in you, the hope of glory.
So what I want to do this morning to start off with, thank you, buddy, is to talk about what the word glory means, and then we'll begin to trace out this theme. So there's a story in the Bible in which someone asks God to show him his glory. You remember what that story is, who it is that makes that request? Yeah, it's Moses, and it's in the part of the book of Exodus where the people of Israel have come out of Egypt. They've gone to Mount Sinai. Moses has gone up to be with the Lord. The people make the unfortunate choice of building the golden calf. Moses intercedes for the people. And then it's right after that that Moses asks to see God's glory. And do you remember, how does that story pan out? What happens to Moses? Yeah, he starts glowing, that's right. Or if you've seen the Ten Commandments, his hair turns gray, right? And so Charlton Heston, his hair just turns gray like that. So apparently a lot of us in here have seen the glory of God, if that's what it does, yeah. Well, first of all, the Lord basically tells Moses that he couldn't handle it if he were to see the full, broad, exposed display of the glory of God. So where does he have to go? Yeah, the famous story about the cleft of the rock. He takes shelter in the cleft of a rock, and then the glory of God passes by, although it's just kind of odd the way the text puts it, but it's the best way you could convey the idea to us. The idea is almost that Moses doesn't see the full frontal display of God's glory. It's kind of like, you know, when you were a kid and there would be an eclipse and you'd go out, but they would say to you, now you can't look directly into the sun. So they would do that cardboard box thing, you know, where you can kind of see the shadow move. Maybe some of you had that same experience. So what Moses gets, the Bible talks about, God says, you can't see my face, but you'll see my back. So it's sort of like Moses, we might put it like this, he sees residual glory. He sees like the residue of God's glory. But even that was so amazing that, as you all said, it changes Moses' appearance to the point, what does Moses have to do when he goes to appear before Israel? Yeah, he has to cover his, has to put a veil over. Yeah. Now that gives us then one definition of what the word glory means. And that is just basically something that is bright, that shines, that has splendor or radiance. The New Testament version of this story, you might say, is the Mount of Transfiguration. When the Bible says that Jesus' appearance was transfigured and he began to gleam, and the text says his face became brighter than the sun and his clothes whiter than any launderer could whiten them. And it says in Luke 9 that they saw his glory. So that would be one meaning of the word glory. is just the basic idea of that sort of radiance. But then another way to think about it is radiance or magnificence in a deeper sense. Like, for example, in the temptation, it says that the devil took Jesus up on a high mountain and showed him the kingdoms of the world and all their glory. Or in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, Jesus says, when he talks about the lilies of the field, not even Solomon in all his glory was arrayed like these. So that's using the word glory in a broader sense of magnificence or greatness. And probably we should think about that even back when Moses wants to see God's glory, because it is that bright, radiant presence of God which is a part of his magnificence, as the way the New Testament and the Old Testament conceive of God. And then there's a third sense here in which it is magnificence or honor, something splendid about someone. So think of splendor, splendid, okay? Something splendid about someone that you want to brag about. And that's why in John chapter 12, we are told that there were those who, even among the Pharisees, believed in Jesus, but they were not willing to confess him, lest they be put out of the synagogue, for they love some of your Bibles say the praise, but it's this same word, the glory that comes from man, more than the glory that comes from God. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means the idea of the honor, the acclaim, being told you're splendid in who you are, that kind of recognition of status and prestige. So when Paul says in Colossians 1 that the plan of salvation in a nutshell is Christ in you, the hope of glory, well, what is it a hope for? Well, on one hand, it's a hope for this splendid radiance, this shining brightness, something about us being changed. But it's also a hope for glory on that much deeper level of recognition by God himself as one of his. So that's the idea then of glory as the Bible talks about it. Now, before we talk about the hope of glory in particular, I do think it's important to get some facts set before us that I think people are, I will say this certainly for myself, often sometimes confused about what the New Testament says when we think about the future glory that awaits us. So let me sort of break things down like this just to have a good idea of what we're going to be talking about. The Bible teaches that as human beings, there is an aspect of us that, one way to put it is outer, and another aspect that is inner. As when Paul says, our outward man perishes, our inward man is renewed day by day. And there's a lot of terms and ways that we can think about that. But the basic concept here is that you and I, as human beings, are composed of both a body and a soul. And that's what life is. Life is when the soul and body are joined together. Now then, what happens at death? Yeah, that there is a separation that takes place at death, when body and soul are disconnected from each other, when that inner and outer aspect of who we are is ruptured. That's what happens at death. But there is one other phase to our existence, and that is when in the resurrection, our body and soul will be reunited, but it will be a new and a transformed body. Now, the reason I'm laying this out to you is, you know, having just recently experienced the loss of my wife and getting a lot of consolation, it reminded me of sometimes the imprecise way I have thought about these things and that I think other people think about things. So like, for example, when my uncle passed away a few years ago, at his funeral, somebody said. Well, you can just imagine John Scott now up in heaven hunting and enjoying the outdoors like he used to here. Well, I understand what they're trying to say, that there is a reality that he can enjoy that's even going to be better than here and now. But what the Bible teaches is that right now, my Uncle John is not hunting because he doesn't have a body. His body was separated from his soul. There's that inner-outer connection has been severed. That's what death itself is. Or sometimes people will say, you know, when Christy passed away, well, now she's whole again. She's not whole again, not right now. Because right now, her soul and her body have been separated from each other. That's what death is. But when people say those things, their instinct is right because they are acknowledging that when death happens, it's not the end of the story. So that's the thing that is right. But what the Bible teaches is when that story actually is completed is in the future when there is the resurrection of the dead, when that inner and outer person are reconnected, and but that the body is transformed. So the reason I wanted to lay this out before you is because when we look at these passages, and there's a bunch of them, that's why it's going to take two classes to get through, that talk about the glory that awaits us, of these three sort of modes of existence, which one would you say the New Testament mostly talks about when it talks about our glory that is to be ours? Yeah. Mostly, what we're going to be talking about is that far right-hand side of the board. What will be true in the future in the resurrection? We have a lot of questions about the middle part of this slide. You know, what's Christie's existence like right now, for example? You know, what about Miss Dorothy? Others here who have passed on, but they're in that in-between phase between life here with a spirit and a body and life in the future with a spirit and a new body. But right now, there's that in-between state. In fact, sometimes, I know you all have these study Bibles now, so I have to use terms I would have never used because I know some of you got them right down here. You're reading them right there. So sometimes this is called the intermediate state. Intermediate between what? Between life now and life in the future and the resurrection, the in-between or intermediate state. Well, we have a lot of questions about what that state is exactly like. And the reason we have a lot of questions is because the New Testament just doesn't spell out in a whole lot of detail exactly what this is like. It's much more focused on the resurrection and the glory of the resurrection. I can point you, though, to one passage that does give us some idea of maybe how to conceive of all of this. So if you would turn to the book of 2 Corinthians to the end of the fourth chapter. Just so you know, I've been doing a lot of reading and studying on some of these things. And I'm going to have all the answers probably in just a few weeks, most likely. I'm not going to have all the answers, but I am trying to do some things to maybe later this year do some classes and preaching on this topic. But what I wanted to point out to you here is if you look at the end of 2 Corinthians 4, by the way, Paul has just talked about suffering like Christ. We read this passage last week. You remember verse 11 or verse 10, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, that Paul in his body, as he suffered physically, it's as if you can see the suffering of Jesus being sort of recreated in his body. But he says this in verse 16. So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of... Ding, ding, there's our key concept for the class, eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison as we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, temporary, temporal, but the things that are unseen are eternal. For, so ignore the chapter break. For, we know that if the tent, that is our earthly home, is destroyed, talking about this outer man that's perishing, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands. In other words, the new body is not going to be like a natural body. Eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan. How many of you groan in this tent? I'm trying to get out of the habit of groaning when I sit down and stand up. But I've developed that habit and I just can't stop doing it. So I figure it's probably going to get worse. So yeah, in this tent we groan, longing to put on what? Our heavenly dwelling. If indeed by putting it on we may not be found what? Naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. But then he says, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. So when you think about the way Paul describes this here, if you think about your body as the tent, the outer man, and we groan in it, and he says at death we put it off, we sort of take it off, but he says that isn't how we want to remain. He says, if you think about the analogy here, that would be like remaining in what condition? Yeah, it'd be naked. So he says the goal is not to be naked, but to be further what? To be further clothed. Yeah. So what you can draw from this then is that at death, when the soul is severed from the body, that is not how God intends for things to remain. God created us to be embodied creatures. And death severs that. And that's what Paul describes here, is the idea of almost being naked. So you don't want to be naked, you just want to be further clothed. You want to have a better set of clothes than you've got right now, is the idea. And that's what the resurrection body will be, a better set of clothes, a better tent. Because it's not going to be a tent. Think about it. He describes the contrast here is between, in verse 1, a tent and a building. What's the difference between those two? Permanence. Yeah, the tent is temporary. That's why it's a tent. You can pick it up and move it around. It's going to be temporary. But a house is eternal. And that's the whole idea here then, the giving up the temporary for the eternal. All right, so this is one passage that kind of talks a little bit about this in-between state at death. But what most of the New Testament focuses on, and especially when it talks about glory, the weight of glory far beyond all comparison, is in the eternal state when we have a soul plus a new body. All right, any questions on the big picture here before we start to look through passages that talk about this? Yeah, Patty?
Would you consider that the reason Moses saw the back of God was because he was afraid of God? That part of our glory on our resurrection will be to actually see his face?
Yes, I think Patty has just said something that's quite profound, that Moses, the best Moses could see was the quote-unquote back of God, because in this realm of existence, that's the best we could possibly do. But that when the Bible talks about the future, just as there is a new body, there is a new order called the new heavens and new earth. And if you remember from the end of Revelation 21 and 22, what makes that truly grand and special is that we see God. Now, exactly how we see him, the Bible obviously is conveying to us something about a direct and immediate presence of God that is unlike anything we could experience now. But yeah, precisely, that's the very point, because it is that new order in which that takes place. Yeah?
So the further point is,
sure.
Jesus also said, if you see me, you see my Father. But we were seeing Jesus in his earthly
birth. Right. Right. No, I think that there, in fact, I'm going to preach about that this morning in John 14. If you, Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And I think the idea would be kind of like this. I remember when I was in grade school, I had a terrible time learning how to subtract, where you have to borrow. I just couldn't get it. Or we might say I couldn't see it. And I had good teachers, really good teachers, actually, in my elementary school. But for some reason, Joan Barry went up to the board, one of my fellow students, and did a subtraction problem on the board, and I could see it. Now, on one level, what I saw were chalk marks on a board. But on a much more profound level, I grasped a truth. And I might say I see her writing the problem on the board, and I see how subtraction works. But the second kind of seeing is much greater than the first. Do you see my point? All right. So you see me, you see the Father. There's like two kinds of seeing going on here, right? Just like you see the problem on the board, but you see actually how it works. And that's the ultimate goal here for sure. Great, great questions. Good instincts, Patty, I think, on these very questions. All right, well, with that in mind, let's... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Chris? Now, wait just a minute here. We're talking about an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, and you're going to try to go wah, wah on that. So I'm really anxious to see how you're going to pull this one off here.
We're talking about those who are raised in glory.
Yes. Right. Well, that is a downer for sure, isn't it? Here, he was able to do it. Well, there is Romans 2 talks about tribulation and distress. Now, if you're asking, like, specifically, what is that going to be like? Well, it is described as a resurrection. Jesus calls it in John 5 a resurrection of condemnation. And we do know that one of the sets of images the Bible uses is fire to describe the painfulness of it. But we're also aware that the Bible uses other imagery, right? It talks about outer darkness. And it talks about wailing and gnashing of teeth. And so you do get an idea of intense pain, but also intense isolation, intense darkness. Yeah.
So that kind of leads you to believe that
you will
get a new body as well.
Yeah, although, as you can imagine, most of the New Testament talk about resurrection is talking about the resurrection for Christians, because typically... there are passages designed to give people hope who are Christians, who are suffering, or they've lost loved ones. So naturally, it would be the case that the New Testament talks about the resurrection mostly in terms of the resurrection of Christians. But yeah, in John 5, Jesus talks about all who are in the grave will hear his voice and come forth, those who've done good to the resurrection of life, those who've done evil to the resurrection of condemnation, and Acts 24, Paul says there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So yeah, there is certainly the teaching that all will be raised. So, but most of the attention, as you're going to see in these passages, we'll look at focused on ours. Yeah, great question. All right, well, with that in mind, let's go over to Romans 8. Start off here this morning now looking at some of these passages that specifically talk about being glorified like Christ. Because remember, that's the whole point of our class. So we looked at verses 16 and 17. Previously, when we talked about suffering, the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God, fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. Suffering and glory. And then Paul goes on to talk about that. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God, that would be the angels. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. So what you can see up here about resurrection with regard to the body, Paul says in principle applies to the whole creation. That there is this renewal, just like there is for the body, there will be for the entire creation as well. What Revelation 21 and 22 calls the new heavens and the new earth. So verse 23, and not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. So the idea is at conversion we are given the indwelling Spirit, and that's the first fruits. And the thing about first fruits is, first fruits are the first of more to come, right? So I got home Friday night and found a wonderful set, two packs of strawberries on my porch given to me by the Heatons. And Wanda, I'm sure that's the first fruits, right? Of more to come, right? Right now, just easy. Well, yeah, so the idea is, at conversion, you're given the Spirit, so that's the first fruits. It's kind of like the down payment of much more to come. Well, what is the much more to come? Well, verse 23, we have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we eagerly await for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. So you see, that's the glory that is to come, the new body that we will have, what Paul here calls the redeemed body. And then he talks about waiting for it in patience. And then if you drop down to verses 29 and 30, those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to what? The image of his son, that he might be the first among many brothers. And then you might remember last year I did a sermon on the five steps of salvation. And these are the five steps of salvation. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. And so it's as if Paul steps back and he looks at the full sweep of God's plan of salvation from eternity to eternity. And where does that plan end? What is its ultimate destiny? Glory. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what Paul points us to here in this wonderful passage. Suffering with Christ to be glorified with Christ, like Christ, in the redemption of the body, in the resurrection of the body. All right, any questions on that? All right, now let's move on over to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I wonder if the resurrection body we will sweat. Be kind of nice if that didn't happen. I don't know. All right, so 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 20. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who've fallen asleep. He's the first of more to come that will be raised. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive. But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ. That's why the resurrection is yet future, because it happens at the second coming. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father, after destroying every rule and authority and power, for he must reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that is to be destroyed is death. Now then, usually at this point, somebody has the same kind of question that Paul mentions in verse 35. How are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? You ever have that question? Well, what kind of body will it be? Well, look at the next verse. You foolish person. Maybe we shouldn't ask that question, right? Like, don't ask questions like that, you know? Well, now, Paul does give us some ideas here. He gives us an answer. First of all, he gives us an illustration, like in verse 37. And what is the illustration he gives there? It's like a seed that is sown. So you take a seed. or maybe a bulb of a tulip. And you put it in the ground, and it dies, so to speak. We would say it germinates. And then out comes the plant or the flower. Now, on the one hand, do the seed or the bulb and the plant or the flower, do they look anything alike? They look completely different from each other. On the other hand, is there a continuity there? Is there a connection there? Sure is. Seed in the ground is what? So there is both sameness, it's the same seed that is now the plant, and yet something vastly different. It was just a seed, now it's the full bloom of the flower or the plant. So you could say it's the same but different, right? Well, that's what Paul says the resurrection body is going to be like. It's the same but different. On the one hand, there's a body that goes into the ground, and there's a body that will be given to us. So they're both bodies. But on the other hand, there is as much difference, we might think in our minds, between the new body and the current body as there is between the flower and the seed. So there is both continuity and discontinuity. Now then the other way Paul describes this is with a pair of opposites. So verse 42, so with the resurrection of the dead, what is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. What is sown is in dishonor, it is raised in glory. And remember, honor, glory, to give somebody honor and praise is part of the idea of this word. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Now, let me just pause here just for a second, because we need to be very careful in how we think about this terminology. I want you to notice that what Paul says here is the opposite of spiritual is what term? Natural. He doesn't say physical. He says natural. Now, what do I mean by that? What's the difference in that? Well, think about it like this. Hold your place here and go back to chapter 10. Where Paul uses the analogy of Israel in the wilderness, comparing it to Christ. And I want you to look in 1 Corinthians 10 at verses 3 and 4 when Paul talks about what the Israelites ate and drank in the wilderness. What kind of food and what kind of drink does he say that they ate and drank? Spiritual. Spiritual food, spiritual drink. Now, let me ask you this question. What did the Israelites eat in the wilderness? Manna. What it looked like. You can describe what it looked like, can't you? In fact, the text even talks about it being like coriander seed. Now, if I knew what coriander seed was, then that would really help me out, but I don't know what that is. But that's how it describes it. And then they drank water that came from a rock. But Paul says here in this passage in 1 Corinthians 10 that this food and this drink were spiritual. Well, it was actually like manna. It could crumble. You could describe its texture and color. And it was water that could, you know, assuage your thirst. So what does he mean then when he says it was spiritual food and drink? Yeah, it's provided by God. It's provided, you might say, supernaturally, as opposed to food and drink provided naturally. See that? It was actual food that you could put your hands on, drink that you could swallow, but it was supernaturally provided, not naturally provided. So when you come back here to 1 Corinthians 15, and Paul makes the contrast with regard to the resurrection body in verse 44, natural versus spiritual. And we know what he meant by spiritual back in chapter 10. It's something supernaturally provided. Then that helps us to understand why here in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says the opposite of spiritual, as he uses the term, is natural. You might, instead of spiritual, you could substitute the phrase or the term supernatural, because it's that provided by the Spirit as opposed to provided by nature. Make sense to you? And so we have this body is the one provided by nature. The new body is going to be one provided by the Spirit, supernaturally given. All right, and that's what Paul's talking about here. Well, what's it going to be like? Well, I already told you that's a foolish question. Don't ask that question, all right? All I can say is it will be as much greater than this body as the flower is the seed. But there, it will still be just like a flower you can put your hands on and a seed you can put your hands on. They're both something you can put your hands on. It will be a body that has structure to it, but it's just going to be vastly different because it's something supernaturally provided. That is provided by the Spirit. The thing is, I want you to see here is Paul is saying it's going to be like, it's going to be glory like Christ. Remember, he uses the term in verse 43, glory. And then as you continue on, he says in verse 46, but it's not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven, as was the man of dust. So also are those who are of the dust. So that's us, like Adam. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven, those of us who follow Christ. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man in heaven. In other words, we're going to be like Christ in the resurrection. Make sense to everybody? So again, this is a reason I wanted to keep this slide up here, is it keeps focusing our attention on there's the current situation, spirit and this body. There is death when those are severed. Then there is the reunion, but with a new body. Now we can layer in all these terms here, glorious, imperishable, immortal, spiritual, as contrasted with this body. All right, but all in the context of glorification like Christ. That's the main thing that I want you to get out of this passage. Any questions or comments here on this passage? All right. Well, let's move on over to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians. Third chapter, and this one is drawing on the very imagery of that story from Exodus regarding Moses and the glory of God. And you can see Paul reference that in verse, it was bell number one, right? So you can see him reference it up in verse 13. We're not like Moses who would put a veil over his face so the Israelites wouldn't gaze and so forth. Verse 16, when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. It's a powerful image. I remember Marty is the one, for those of you visiting with us, Marty Pickup, who preached here for years before I did. It was one of my teachers in college. Marty was the one who really drew my attention to this passage for the first time. And he talked about the fact that the problem with unbelieving Israel is they have a veil over their face. And that's why looking at the law does not do any good, because they're looking at it with a veil. But when they come to Christ, the veil is removed, and now the law and the prophets make total sense. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. And right now, they are trying to solve the jigsaw puzzle, and they don't have the box top. But once you see Christ, that's the box top, then the veil comes off. It all makes sense. All the pieces fit together. So that's what he says in verse 16. Verse 17, now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Verse 18, and we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image. So think about it. Moses saw the glory of God, and what happened? He was changed. He was transformed by it. And now Paul says, all of us beholding the glory of the Lord are similarly being transformed into the same image. And then the English Standard Version says, from one degree of glory to another. That's interpretive. Those of you who use the New American Standard Bible, what does yours say? Glory to glory. All right, so that's the literal. Well, what glory to what glory? So other translations try to interpret it because it sort of doesn't make sense on its own. You've got to kind of supply something. Any other translations besides from glory to glory or from one degree of glory to another? Anybody have anything else? But the idea here that I want you to see see is, just as Moses beheld the glory of God and he was transformed gloriously, the same holds true for us as we behold the glory of the Lord. What's happening to us? We are being transformed as well from glory to glory, so that the glory of Christ then becomes ours. And at the end of the verse, for this comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. So when Paul says, this is the plan of salvation, Christ in you, the hope of glory, can you see now, based on just the passages we've looked at, this is why you would say this, because the New Testament says a lot about this. All right, yeah, Darren?
The NIV says ever-increasing glory.
Oh, ever-increasing glory. I could buy that. That's a pretty good idea here, too, I think. And considering the fact that the Lord is glory in the infinite and perfect sense, are we ever going to run out of how much glory we will increase as we behold it? No. Because if it's infinite, that means we will just in eternity go from one depth of glory to the next, and never plumb the depths. And remember, glory in the sense of bright, splendid, fame, honor, prestige, recognition, all of those things blending together as you think about glory. All right, this is an exciting passage. So I'm trying to pull you out of the doldrums after Chris started talking about damnation over here. So trying to get us back on track here. So any questions or comments up through these passages right here? All right, well, let's see if we can start at least one more here. Let's look over in Philippians. Verse 8. Sorry, I guess I got to tell you the chapter, right? Philippians 3 and verse 8. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake I've suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection, and may share his what? All right, share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection of the dead. I share in his suffering so that I can share in his resurrection. All right, well, we'll continue on there, because at the end of Philippians 3 is one of the most beautiful passages of all about the resurrection. But you kind of get the theme here that we're tracing through the New Testament. And this is, you know, I tell you all, you can just never do what I do, because here's how complicated this study was. I wrote down the word glory, typed it into BibleGateway.com and hit enter, looked at all the passages and then wrote them down, and now we're reading them. So, I mean, this is really complicated stuff here. Our only experts could do this. But I do hope you're getting the sense of just how many passages there are that talk about this.